First question, I'm depressed. Excellent. Very good. You have just uncovered the first noble truth of suffering. Well done. So when you're depressed, what are you going to do about it? Love your depression. When you're depressed, you get many benefits. You don't have to get up early in the morning. You don't have to go to work. You don't have to achieve anything because you're depressed. You can't do anything anyway. You can sleep as much as you like. And you can eat whatever you want. You don't have to worry about healthy food because you're depressed. And it means other people can look after you and care for you because you're depressed. And you can say whatever you want. You can call people pigs and cows and bitches, whatever, because you're depressed. So when you are depressed, please milk it for as much as you possibly can. And enjoy your depression. You don't always get depressed. Unfortunately, depression doesn't last. It passes. So when you are depressed, enjoy it to the max. That's my answer to depression. In other words, don't be depressed about being depressed. That's the only reason why you stay depressed. You get upset about being depressed. Open the door of your heart to depression. Or, I've told this story so many times in the interviews about the anger-eating demon. There was a monster which came into the emperor's palace. I hope you all know this by now. I've told it so many times. The monster came into the emperor's palace where the emperor was away, sat in the emperor's chair, and everybody said, "Get out of here, you don't belong. You're a monster, you're not the emperor. Get out!" And of those few unkind words, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. That really upset everybody in the palace. "Get out of here! I told you once, we'll tell you no more times, you're going to be in big trouble. Get out!" Ugh. And, do I make a good job of being angry? Should I put it, give it more pizzazz? "Get out of here!" That's really good fun doing that. I don't get much chance to say things like that. And every unkind word, deed or thought, demon got bigger, uglier, smelly, more offensive. When the emperor came back, the monster was huge, so ugly that... this is a TV program, Ugly Betty. Listen, I've never seen that, obviously, don't watch TV. But even Ugly Betty was nowhere near as ugly as this monster. And the smell which came off this monster, this is my nice little addition here, the stench was so bad that even the maggots, the worms crawling over his skin, were sick and vomited. And the language coming off this monster was worse than you'd hear, maybe, where are you mostly from? A few from Indonesia. Worse than if you supported Mitt Romney and you lost the election and all the bad speech they had afterwards. And the reason when the emperor came back, the reason he was the emperor, he was smart, he knew what to do. He said, "Welcome, monster. It's so rare to get an ugly monster like you coming to visit me. Thank you so much for coming here." Because it's good having a monster around because it makes everyone else look beautiful. I was complaining, one of my monks, I was just over at tea time, and I was saying, "You look too thin. You're embarrassing me." Because if all the monks are fat, then it's okay, you know, just you don't stand out. So I said, sit over there somewhere so you can't compare. So having a monster is sometimes quite good. Everyone looks beautiful. Then, what else is there? Oh, yeah. And so the emperor said, "Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming. Why have you waited so long to drop by? Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet? We have Darjeeling. We have Earl Grey. We have special tea from the highlands of Sri Lanka. That's my favorite. And we've also got peppermint tea if you want something good for your health. We have orange juice. We have..." What have you got in the kitchen these days? You've got heaps of stuff over there. And just those few kind words, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And now everybody realized their mistake. So instead of giving it negativity, they started looking after the monster, being really, really kind to it. And his feet were so big, it had about 6 or 7 people, went around the left foot, another 8 people on the right foot, because they weren't the same size. Monsters are like that. And they gave him a foot massage. Have you ever had a foot massage? It's really nice. Imagine a monster, so rare you get a foot massage. And the monster, just over here, just say, ooh, that's really nice. Ooh, yeah, ooh, ooh, ooh. Thank you so much. And every time they hit the sweet spot in the monster's foot, it grew an inch smaller. Because every act of kindness, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And they were so kind to this monster, soon it was back to the size when it first came in. But they carried on with the kindness. Somebody called out for a pizza. You know, you can get monster-sized pizzas these days. So also, pizza monster-sized, please. Before the pizza boy arrived with the delivery, one more act of kindness, because the monster was so small, one more act of kindness and the monster vanished completely away. And the Buddha told that story, my additions as usual, and he called that anger-eating demon. You give it anger, get out of here, you don't belong. It gets bigger. And depression is an anger-eating demon. Get out of here, you don't belong. The depression gets deeper, bigger, more of a problem. You can say, welcome, thank you for visiting me. Then it gets an inch smaller. And there's so many other anger-eating demons in meditation. So in your interviews, you know, I remind you of that story so I don't have to keep telling it from the beginning again. Anger-eating demons, so many are problems in your meditation. Restless, thinking too much, sloth and torpor, frustration, whatever. Welcome frustration. Thank you for coming to visit me. And you give it kindness and it gets less. Dear Bhante, in regards to the truth of rebirth, are there any other skillful means apart from reading relevant near-death experience and past life research to help convince those Buddhists who ascribe to the one life only view as espoused by Stephen Batchelor, secular Buddhism? Thank you. Yeah, of course there's a way. Die. And then you will find out. People always say, no, actually it's also, if you get into jhanas, what happens in jhanas? Remember this, the mind is there, very bright, very clear, and your 5 senses have stopped. And that's exactly what happens when you die. Your 5 senses stop, your brain stops, you've just got the mind left. So jhana is like a death rehearsal. You're finding out what it's like. And you all know when people have the near-death experience, they float off towards the light. That's exactly the same as a nimitta, which you experience in deep meditation. So actually, jhanas is just finding out what it's like to die. And realizing the body has stopped, the 5 senses have shut down, but you're still there. So it's pretty obvious what happens after you die. So you do that when you're alive, right here in Jhana Grove. You discover what's going to happen to you when you die. You're rehearsing it. People always say we are what we eat. But monks eat everything. So we are what we eat, or we are what we think. No, monks are one with everything. Isn't that what you're supposed to be? You know that the old joke about the monk who went to go to the McDonald's store and said, make me one with everything. You know, with a McDonald's hamburger. Make me one. Come on. You must have heard that joke before. Make me one with everything. That was the aspiration, to be at peace with everything. So we're at peace with everything, without judging or distinction. And you know that joke about the schizophrenic Buddhist? The schizophrenic Buddhist who wants to be two with everything. It's a really hard audience here to get to laugh. Sheepers. So, are we what we eat or what we think? We're none of those. We're not what we eat. We're not what we think. We're not what we do. There's nobody there. We're empty. And because monks realize emptiness, we're so empty, you can put anything in. When you're full up, you can't put much in. Ajahn Sister Wayang was my first meditation teacher. I keep thinking of her with gratitude. Can you please tell me how she is? Thank you. Yeah, she had a cerebral degeneration. No one actually knows why. So some part of her brain got damaged. No one knows exactly why. Had all the tests in the world. No one could find out. But she is slowly degenerating, but still sort of okay in herself. It's just the brain, that's all. So that's what she's doing. You can go and see her if you like after the retreat. I'll give her a call. Your Honourable Emptiness, thanks for your story about the Thai novice this morning. I stopped running away from myself today. No jhanas yet, but it's so peaceful and enjoyable. Yay, see, it works. I told you so. So stop running away from anything. You can't run away from yourself. Where are you going to go? Wherever you go, you're there. It's the trouble with life. You know, you go to Singapore, you go to Las Vegas, you go... Wherever I go, there I am. Actually, I don't go anywhere. I just sit here and all these scenes in the aircraft just go past me. I don't go anywhere. I'm just sitting still. The aircraft moves. The car moves. My legs move. But I'm always here. Isn't that the truth? So you don't go anywhere. You're always here. How to control our anger and greed? When you control things, you get more angry and more greed. So let go of control. And then anger disappears. Anger. It's because you're frustrated. You're not getting what you want. And so you blame somebody. It's your fault. It's Ajahn Brahm's fault. It's Janagro's fault. It's Dania's fault. It's Bianca's fault. Oh, yeah, it's my fault. This is what anger is. You get frustrated because you want something and you don't get it. The obvious solution to that is don't want anything. When you don't want anything, you never get frustrated. So, lower your expectations. Lower your expectations of me. Lower your expectations of Bianca and Daniel. And more, if you're married, lower your expectations of your husband. I mean, they're all pretty low already, but lower them a bit further. And then you'll be really happy in life. Because when you expect something, that's when you get angry. You know what happens? You know, life is always improving, so we expect more and more and more and more. You know, you go in the aircraft, you expect it to always leave on time. You expect the food to be always nice. You know, you expect everything just to be so, so nice. Because that expectation causes a lot of stress. As for me, I expect things to go wrong. So when they go wrong, I'm satisfied. Yeah, you see, I was right. I expect people to get sick. So when you get sick, you say, I feel really sick today, I've got a cold. See, I told you so. And when you die, I expect you to die. So when somebody calls up and says, do you know that person who came on the retreat, they died today. They're only 22, and they're dead. I say, I expected that. Are you shocked when somebody dies? That's really stupid. People die all the time. Look in the newspapers, go to the crematoriums, it's always full there. People are dying to get into those crematoriums. That's terrible. But, so when we don't understand what the world can give us, when we expect something more, that's when we get angry. So just lower your expectations to meet what the world can give. What a husband, what a wife can give you. Lower your expectations for what a kid is. I said yesterday, half the children in the world are below average intelligence. And some of those will be your kids. It's obvious. So lower your expectations. Don't expect your kids always to go to universities. Not everyone can get in there. When you lower your expectations, then anger disappears. And for your greed, what do you want to get greedy for? If I had $1 million, would you like it? If you're wise, you say, no, thank you. If you're very wise. Then you just get too much money and you don't know what to do with it. Sociological and psychological research has found there is an optimum income for a person in today's world. And I think in Australia it was about $50,000 a year. If you earn more than that, you've got excess money, you have to invest it, and that's really a lot of worry. No, the stock market goes up, the stock market goes down. Should I invest it in a bank? Should I invest it in sort of some company, which, you know, they always still get their commission? You don't know what to do. It's a lot of worry and concern. Too much money causes you too much stress. Too little money is very stressful. You can't afford to do what you love doing. So it's obvious there is an optimum amount of income, which is the maximum happiness. Too much is too much worries and stress. You don't have any moment of peace. Too little, you can't afford the basic necessities of life and just being able to travel, come to Jhana Grove and things like that. So in Australia, a few years ago, it was about $50,000. Maybe, and over inflation, maybe $60,000 a year. So, if there's anybody in this room who is earning more than $60,000 or the equivalent a year, I can help you become more happy. You don't believe me, do you? Give it a try, you'll be much more happy. And though greed is just asking for things which will never give you happiness. So you ask, what do you really want anyway? Isn't it nice to ask, what do I really want? What you want is peace. Respect, happiness. Those are the things you want. I better carry on with this. There's too many questions. Anyway, aside from reading the relevant near death and past, that's what I did that one already. Skillful means to get. Can I read a book during this retreat? No. Anapanasati in Buddhist meditation experience? Yes. Mindfulness, Buddhist and Beyond is Ajahn meditation experience? Yes. Thanks with metta. Easy. Yeah, of course you can read during the retreat. And Anapanasati is a Buddhist meditation experience. So they say. But who knows? I can't ask the Buddha anymore. Maybe they made it up. Who knows what the Buddha did? Why do you want to know anyway? Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond is Ajahn's meditation experience. Those are just the menu. Taste the food and you'll find out what is the experience. So, if it was my experience, it wouldn't be worth reading, would it? You have to read your own experience. Write your own book on meditation, bliss and beyond for yourself. Experience it first. Ajahn, can you offer hints regarding how to focus your attention on the breath? I've been doing that for the last 4 days. Oh, you haven't been paying attention. Sometimes the breath is finishing at the top, still filling at the bottom, etc. Is the attention a little here? A little like a camera lens adjusted to suit the distance from point of entry to the lungs. You don't worry about the lungs or where it's going in, where it's going out. You just know. You ask a 5-year-old kid to watch your breath and they can do it very easily because they don't think too much. So it's just, you know the breath's going in, you know the breath's going out. It doesn't matter where it's going in. It might be going in through your left ear. Who cares? As long as you know it's going in, you know it's going out. That is enough. Don't focus on the body. Focus on the breath. When thoughts of sexual desire automatically... Oh, this is censored, this one. I better not read this out. Shall I? Course. When thoughts of sexual desire automatically and uncontrollably come into our minds, and we actually do enjoy the presence of the thoughts without doing anything about it, are we breaking one of the precepts? you are breaking the thought precept. So, there was a monk I grew up with in Thailand. He's this big American monk, and he had lots of sexual desire and fantasy. And so he had to go up to ask Ajahn Chah. He said, "Lord, what should I do? They're uncontrollable sometimes. I want to be a monk, but all these thoughts come in." He says, "Very easy. The next time you give a talk, don't give a talk about Four Noble Truths. Just tell all the people who've been feeding you for the last few years what you're really thinking about." "I can't do that," he said. "Well, if you do that, it will soon cure you. And actually, many of the people listening will pay attention for a change." So, no, look, if you're a young man or a young woman or you're old or whatever, it doesn't matter, it seems these days, I don't know. When things like this come up, what are you thinking these things for anyway? A lot of time because you're bored. And it's just your escape from the suffering of frustration. But when your mind is, you've actually followed the instructions for a change, you know, you actually just make peace, be kind, be gentle, you actually do that, you do get peaceful and you get very, very happy. You don't need sexual fantasies or thoughts because you're having a good time. And be careful, because some monks can read your minds. Shall I tell everybody what you have been thinking? That really worried me when I went to see these monks. But you know, I was a young monk and have all the thoughts as well. And I thought, "Oh God, please Ajahn Chah, don't leave my mind, don't leave my mind." But when you get content and peaceful, all those thoughts disappear. How come some people talk about 8 jhanas and you talk about 4 jhanas? Thanks and much metta. It's sometimes 4 jhanas, but actually, to be accurate, the last 4 are called arupa attainments. They're never actually called jhana in suttas. In the commentaries in Abhidharma, they're called jhanas, but in the Buddha called them immaterial attainments. He never used the word jhana for them. So the really jhanas are usually just 1, 2, 3, 4. "Dear Ajahn, I try to live in the present moment, but I always have a monkey mind. How to overcome it?" We can have the operation. It's called a lobotomy. And then you're just in the present moment. "I already sit in comfortable position, but my mind just won't shut up." Stop trying to make the mind shut up. A lot of times it's because you're trying, then it won't. Just let it be. So make peace. Be kind to your mind. Be gentle. And then your mind stops by itself. Stop controlling the mind. Remember that simile? Now, I gave the simile of the lake. Ajahn Chah would get his hand up and wave it like this. He wasn't waving a bus or saying bye-bye. He was saying, "This is a leaf in the forest. When the wind is blowing, it moves up and down." That's not the nature of a leaf. That's just what happens when the wind blows. But when the wind stops, it still moves. But less and less and less, until the leaf becomes perfectly still, because that's its natural default state, to be still. Same as your mind, it's naturally still. It only moves like a monkey mind because of wanting, any type of wanting. That's like the wind which moves the leaves. Wanting moves your mind. So even wanting those thoughts to stop actually makes them move even more. So take away all the wanting. Just let it be. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. Don't want it to be different. Then with that unconditional mindfulness. I say unconditional mindfulness because you're aware of things no matter what it is. No judging, no good, no bad. Just knowing without saying good or bad. And then because you're not wanting anything, you're just being, you find all the thoughts get less and less and less. Your monkey settles down and becomes a human being. So that's how you do it. You just stop wanting. And this is a problem because We want it to stop, we control it and it gets worse and we get frustrated. Sometimes the frustration is great, because after a while you get so frustrated, I give up. And then you get peaceful. Because you let go. So stop wanting. Number two, wanting is always looking into the future. Wanting it to be something else. If you stay in the present moment, really stay in the present moment, you're stuck with this. There can't be any wanting. No frustration, because it's here. So, being in the present moment is the second way. I mean, really being in the present moment, you can't want anything. All wanting means you have to have some perception of the future. Some place you're not where you want to get to. So just be in the moment. Make peace with your monkey mind. Stop wanting it to be different. Once there was a man who had a chicken. He wanted it to be a duck. How suffering he was. So if you want your mind to be different than it is, that's suffering. So if it's a monkey mind, welcome monkey mind. Just like that demon in the Emperor's palace. Welcome, thank you for visiting me. And then the mind gets less and less active. It just settles down. Stop wanting. Go the opposite direction. Make peace. How to have a silent world? How to have a silent world after I leave this world? A lot of routines. In other words, I think when you leave this retreat center, it's very easy to have a silent. Use earplugs when you go to work. Then it's a silent. You don't hear anything. But I think you really mean inner silence. And again, for inner silence, once you get to know silence and respect it, it will stay much longer. A lot of times when you have a moment of silence, you disrespect it, so you throw it away. You don't know its value. Like throwing away gold. Once you know the value of silence, and it's more important than thinking, you'll find silence stays with you longer and longer and longer. So change your value system. Don't value thinking. It never answers the questions anyway. Silence does answer the questions. Truth lies in silence, never in thoughts. So when you value silence and you give it extra value, then the mind will always incline to what it thinks is important, what it thinks is valuable. So it will incline to silence more and more. Take away the value from thinking. It never answers the questions, it just drives you crazy, it just drives you round and round and round. And instead, be a silent sage rather than a crazy thinker. Just wondering if you could share some of your experiences meeting various Ajahns from Thailand and Sri Lanka. I am particularly interested in Ajahn Buddhadasa. Do you have any anecdotes about him? I never met him, but the previous abbot here, Ajahn Jakro, he met him. And he told this really funny story about him. I never forget this. He was talking to this Western monk, this young, I don't know if he was English or something, American probably, young American monk, and he was giving him a nice talk, and was saying that, yeah, this is what you have to do, and he says, if you do this, it's easy to become enlightened, said Ajahn Buddhadasa. And this maybe American, only been a monk for 1 or 2 years. Well, if it's that easy to become enlightened, Ajahn Buddhadasa, why aren't you enlightened? And the next thing which happened, Ajahn Buddhadasa was chasing this man holding his stick through the forest. This really conceited young Westerner. And I was just that picture of a monk chasing a young American through the forest with a stick. I'll show you what enlightenment is. So yeah, it's just, I always have these nice anecdotes of these crazy monks in Thailand. Some of them are extremely wise and very kind. What's the best way of learning to let go of guilt? Since I've become a mother, I've so much guilt in me. Every time I leave my child or not spend so much time with her, I felt guilty. Help, please. Yours, guilty mum. Oh, look, your child is probably having a wonderful time without you. You know, he's got no rules, he can do whatever you like. So sometimes it was great when my mum went away and I just had my dad, because, you know, he was much looser than my mum was. So you asked your kid and said, oh, great, mum, when are you going back, when are you going to retreat again? Yeah, of course your mum is, your kid is glad to see you again. She has to do that because otherwise the game's given up. You know, there was this story of this young boy, maybe about 7 or 8 years of age, and he went into to the barber shop. I think it was in New York somewhere. And the barber who was cutting the hair of a customer said, look, this kid is the stupidest kid in the whole world, and I'll prove it to you. And he said, and he got a dollar in one hand and 2 25-cent coins, this is the United States, in the other. He said, which one do you want? And the kid took the 2 25-cent coins rather than the dollar. See, he's a stupid kid. He always does this. So when the guy had finished having his hair cut, he went outside and saw the kid with an ice cream cone. And he went up to the kid and said, look, you look intelligent. Now why do you always take the 50 cents instead of the dollar? He said, because, sir, as soon as I take that dollar, the game's finished. Never underestimate, you know, the intelligence of your kids. They know what you're doing. I remember my father used to take my brother and I on this treasure hunt. Whenever we went to some place in a forest somewhere, he said, let's look for treasure. And you'd find a sixpence here, a shilling there. And he said, oh, it must be treasure. And then one day, I think my brother let it slip. You know, because we all knew my father just was dropping it all over the place. It came from him. But we didn't want to tell him that, because then the game was over. My brother stupidly said, oh, you know, you dropped too much this time. Shut up, shut up. Kids are very, very smart, but they don't let on because sometimes they lose out if they tell the truth. So your kid is probably very, very good. And also that they appreciate mum when she's been on retreat. That story that, maybe tens of mothers, they've come onto a meditation, usually just on the evening, and they said, I never wanted to come this evening. I just finished work and I was tired. I just wanted to, you know, watch a TV show or something. And they said, my daughter told me, Mummy, you must come to meditation, but I'm tired. Mummy, go to meditation. I don't want to. Mummy, go to meditation. Why, darling? Because you're a much nicer mummy when you come back from meditation. That's true. So going away for 9 days, you're a much nicer mummy. But I'm sure your kid will encourage your guilt trip. Will encourage you, because, Mummy, you left me for such a long time. I want this, I want that, I want that. They'll use that to get what they want from you. They're very smart. So don't feel guilty about it. It's good for the kid and it's good for you. You deserve some space and the kid deserves some space from you. Your honourable emptiness. I'm a bit confused as to whether I'm doing this walking, I'm going to die, that's for sure, meditation correctly. I'm just repeating that saying like a monotonous robot. That saying is the only thing going around in my head. Am I doing it right? You're doing it right if you actually die. You're making a promise and you're not keeping it. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. If you do that for a while, come on, do it. Die. So what to do? You're walking there, I will die, that. If you get bored, just drop down to the ground. And pretend. Oh, I'm dying. And see what you feel like. Now, what you do, if you keep on saying it, see if you can get up to fear. Because if you really are saying, you're really paying attention, it should give rise to fear. You're going to die. I love doing this. This is about 60 people plus some hangers-on from Bodhinyana Monastery. So there's about 70 people here this evening, which means by this time next year, I think 1.2 of you will be dead. That's statistics. Who is it going to be? which one will be dead by this time next year? And don't just look at the old ones. It could be you. Is that scary? It's going to happen, you know. So when you get like that, you really get into it. And once you go through the fear, afterwards, I think it's okay to die. That's just wonderful. I mean, it's a way of letting go and all the problems vanishing and all the attachments being let go of. So when you really get through that fear, I will tell you that's for sure. The next stage is incredible peace. That's why you want people to do this, to go through the fear, and on the other side you have an amazing peaceful state. So if that's not working, then try something else. I will live and that sucks. Or something like that. Mess around. Your emptiness. We may not be as lucky as some to have you guide us by our bedside before we die. Just in case we drop dead and haven't had enough meditation practice to know what to do, can you please be so kind to give us some pointers? Okay, remember when you die to stop breathing. And to let go. So die well. Don't struggle. Everybody who dies and comes back to tell the tale always says it's very, very pleasant once you get past that point of death. Dying is the problem. Death is wonderful. The story of this one woman, I think she was on a BBC documentary somewhere, she died, and floating outside of her body, she was having the time of her life. It was so peaceful, so lovely. And then, you know, they met this spirit somewhere, and the spirit said, "It's not your time. You have to go back." You know, that's very common. And she said, "No way. I don't want to go back to this old stinky body. I'm having a good time." And the spirit said, "But you have to go back. It's not your time." She said, "I don't care. I'm not going back. I'm dead and that's it, okay?" And they had this argument on this astral plane. This big argument. And in the end, the spirit took her in its arms and threw her back into her body. And so she woke up again. She was back in her body. And she remembered everything. And when she was doing this interview, she said, "I'm really angry at that spirit, what that person did to me. When I die next time, you know, for real, I'm going to find that guy. And you wouldn't believe what I'm going to do to him. I'm going to bash him, I'm going to hit him, because he sent me back to this rotten old body to live again, and I was having such a wonderful time before he threw me back in. That's not on." And I love that story because it shows just how wonderful it was to die. Peace, bliss, wonder. So, you know, when it happens, let's come on, bring it on, as George Bush used to say. Let it happen, don't be afraid. The dying is a problem, the death is wonderful. So remember that when you're dying. "I feel more peaceful when I close my eyes and listen to the nature rather than doing meditation in the meditation hall. Is it good or bad?" It depends on what nature. There's people, there's good nature, there's bad nature. You can listen to the trucks on the road, that's nature. You know, all the trucks are natural, it's all made of iron and other natural ingredients, rubber and petrol, that's all natural. What's unnatural? Everything is natural except the supernatural. Are you ready to listen to the supernatural? Ooh, the ghosts are coming. Got loads of... Shall we do a ghost story? Okay, turn the lights down. Oh, that's really good. "There was one of my friends." You've probably heard this one before. If you have, be quiet, remember. For the people who haven't heard this, you've got to be quiet. "He was coming home from the temple after a meditation session. And the way back to his house was passing the cemetery. And it was late at night. It was dark. And even though he didn't believe in ghosts, still, you always tense up when you walk along the road which passes the cemetery. And even though there are street lights, they're always further apart next to the cemetery. And as he was walking, he got to the halfway mark. Nothing had happened. He thought he was safe. He walked a little bit further, and that's when he heard someone was following him. If ever that happens to you, you feel like someone is following you, the last thing you want to do is look around. Instead, you just try walking a little bit faster. So he walked a little bit faster, and he paid attention, and he could hear whatever it was following him also started walking faster. So he started walking really fast, and whatever was following him also walked really fast. And he couldn't resist the temptation any longer. He turned around to look what was following him. He wished he never had. Because when he turned around, what he saw was unbelievable. It wasn't a person following him. It was a coffin. A coffin standing vertically with all dirt and cobwebs off it. Bump, 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 jumping after him. He freaked out. He started running as fast as he possibly could. And the coffin, bump, 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 followed him, not just as fast, but faster. It was catching up with him. He ran as fast as Usain Bolt, but the coffin was running faster, bump, 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 bump. And it was a matter of who would get to the gate first of all of his house, which was close by. He was so lucky, he got to the gate first of all, opened it, slammed it, and ran along the road, and the coffin had to stop before the gate. He thought he was safe until he heard the coffin jump over the gate. He got to his door as the coffin started bumping up the garden path. He got out the key. He dropped the keys. That's what it is when you really get tense. You do stupid things like drop the keys. Bump, bump, bump. The coffin was after him. He picked up the first key, put it in the lock, prayed. It was the right key. He turned it, opened the door, ran inside, slammed the door just as the coffin came to the front door. He just made it by a second or two. And there he was panting. He could see through the glass of his entrance door the coffin on the other side. Bump! Went the coffin right against the front door. Bump! Even harder as the hinges started to give way. Bump! The coffin was breaking down the door. He ran up the stairs to the second story. Just as bump! The coffin broke through the front door. And he was on the top landing of the stairs looking down at the coffin. And the coffin was looking at him. There was only one room which had a lock, the bathroom. He ran in there and slammed the lock shut. Bump, 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 bump. Up the stairs went the coffin. Bump! Against the bathroom door. If that coffin had broken through the front door, it was only a matter of seconds before it would break through the much weaker bathroom door. He spread his arms against the wall. Bump! As the coffin broke through, there was no more place to run. It was just him and the coffin. Instinctively, he reached for a bottle on the shelf in the bathroom, and he threw it at the coffin. And this liquid went all over the coffin, and the coffin stopped. What he threw was very lucky. What he threw was cough mix. It stops the coffin. That's a terrible joke. But thank you for listening. I tell it at most retreats. If a son or a daughter gives the consent to remove the life support of his or her mum, can this be considered as killing, especially when it is the mum, it is an antonaika papa? What happens if that is your mum in a coma? This is serious stuff. You stand or sit by your mum who's in a coma and you ask, "Mum, are you still there?" If she is still there, you will know. You are the daughter, the son, or whatever it is. You're close enough to know that, yeah, there's still somebody there. Sometimes you sit next to the coffin. Next to the gurney. We haven't got that far yet. I've got coffins in my mind. Sometimes you sit next to your mother or father in a coma. And you know there's no one there, they've gone. The stream of consciousness has left. If that's the case, you can tell the doctor, turn off the machine. They're already dead. It's just an empty shell left, that's all. And it's to know whether there's someone there or whether they've gone. I've done that many times for people. You know, just one of the classic cases, this Vietnamese man. And he had a bypass operation, it went wrong. So he was on the edge of life and death for quite a few days. I don't know how I managed to do this. I went into the ICU at Royal Perth about three times every day during this time. Just so much travel, I was getting really tired. But every time I went in there, I kept on going because he really was on the edge. And you give him a big boost of energy, you know, he'd come good and then he'd sort of fall back into the near death. And then one day I went there, or one afternoon, sat by his bed. It felt so different. He'd gone, there's no one left. So I told the doctors, and he's gone, he's dead. And they said, yes, well done. Because I don't know how they know, the doctors, I'm not a doctor myself. But you know that something had happened, he'd just gone. Stream of consciousness had left the body. So I said, look, there's no one left there now. Can't get him back, he's gone. So you know, you can turn the machine off whenever you want. They weren't killing their father. He's already dead. They're just stopping the machine. So that's what you can do, you know, because if that's your mother or father or your daughter or your husband or something, you know whether there's someone there or not. You have to ask the question first of all. Anyone there? You still there, Mum? And just be sensitive. Whatever that intuition tells you is correct. And that's actually how to solve a very difficult problem. It's not right for you to kill your mum or dad. So if there's someone left there, keep the machine going. If there's no one left there, you can turn it off, you're not killing anybody. At some stage in the meditation, the breath fades away, but it comes back. This same thing happens again and again. Why is that? Because you're not ready to die yet. If it comes back too quickly, just make peace, be calm, be still. When the breath disappears, after a while, the nimitta arises. The breath comes back later on, maybe half an hour or so. And then you have a wonderful meditation experience. If it comes back too soon, it means you're not relaxed enough yet. So be confident you're not going to die yet. The breath disappears, but you're still very healthy. So don't worry about it. But just keep on being kind, being mindful. The breath comes back and then it disappears and disappears for longer and longer periods. When it disappears for very long periods, you've got a good chance of seeing these beautiful lights. I can't decide if I want a second child and change the flavour of my suffering. Should I meditate on it for the answer? Please advise. Well, don't have a second child here on the retreat centre. There's way to go back later on and, you know, talk it over with your husband or with your wife, whoever wrote this, and just, you know, feel the answer. Just that's the sort of question. When you have these important life questions, you put all the information into your brain. Get as much information as possible. Can I afford another kid? Is this going to be good for my family? Blah, blah, blah. Once all the information is in, then forget it. Don't keep thinking about it. And then, after a few days, having put the information in, it just works its way through your brain, and you get the answer. It says, yeah, I feel like it's the right thing to do. or you feel, no, that's not the right thing to do. Dear Ajahn, I'm so much delighted in keeping noble silence. I'm just afraid that I don't know how to adjust myself when I'm back to the normal year. Please advise, you're not back yet. Stop running off into the future. You might die before you go home. So don't worry about that until the last day. What should I do when the retreat's over? Nimitta is coming and going. What shall I do? Nothing. Be peaceful, be still, then the nimitta stays. Because you're doing something, that's why it doesn't last. Your honourable emptiness. What is a good place to start learning about practicing the Eightfold Path? Here. That's what you've been doing the last few days. So you're learning the essence of the Eightfold Path. In particular, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention. You know what right intention is? Sammasankappa. It's making peace, being kind, being gentle. What I've been telling you. I haven't put it in those words of Sammasankappa, but that's what it is. You make peace, you be kind, you be gentle. Nekamasankappa, Avayapadasankappa, and Ahimsakasankappa. So you're learning about it right here. I get into a habit of watching the breath at the upper lip to feel the heat cool on exhalation, inhalation at Goenka Ran meditation courses. Can you give me any ideas how to change this and just feel the breath? Thank you. Put anesthetic on your upper lip so you can't fit anything there, and then maybe you could actually do it differently. I don't know, just if that's what works, then do it. You don't have to change. As long as you can watch the breath without any tightness in the head, and you can just watch the breath until the body disappears, fine. Dear Ajahn Brahm, tell us about the music in the 60s in London. Why? What's that got to do with meditation and jhanas? Also, do snakes usually come into the walkways? And do iguanas bite? I think this is one of those jokey questions. So, do snakes usually come into the walk? Because you asked the snakes. Do iguanas bite? No, they're all vegetarians. I really want to walk in the forest areas, but too paranoid about the creepy crawlies. Also, the food here is amazing. I've gained weight since I've came, despite only eating 2 meals a day. And that's why monks only eat 2 meals a day, because they're 3 meals a day. Just imagine what we'd look like. And I'm inherently grateful for all the donors and Bianca and Dani for organising everything. Also, can we get a tour of your cave before the end of the retreat, please? If you get into jhanas, I will give you a tour of the cave. If you don't get into jhanas, then I will give you a tour of the cave anyway. Yeah, you get a tour of the cave later on. Reincarnation. Ajahn, how quickly can a person reincarnation? How soon after passing on? Sometimes immediately, sometimes later. It really depends on how much attachment you have. So if you've got unfinished business, then you don't get reincarnated until that business is finished. There was this Thai lady who had this husband. She was always criticizing the husband. Now this is George and Poonsup, Rodney was helping out on this. And she didn't trust her husband at all. So she came to me when she was getting very sick. She said, look, I can't trust my husband to organize my funeral. So this is the deal. If the Buddhist Society pays for my funeral and organizes it, then half of my estate will go to the Buddhist Society and the rest will go to my husband. I can't decide on those things. I talked to the committee and said, that's a good deal, yes, we'll do it. So she died, we did a funeral service for her, and then afterwards we asked the husband, George, she said, have you got the will? And he said, I can't find it. He said, okay, fair enough. And a few weeks later, have you found the will yet? No, can't find it. Okay. And then one day he came early in the morning to see me. I found the will, I found the will. I said, where did you find it? He said, I woke up in the middle of the night. George, get that will. Give it to the monks. He was so terrified, he couldn't give me that will quick enough. He knew where it was all along. But he needed the ghost of his ex-wife to actually to come in the middle of the night, George, get that will, give it to the monks. And he was so terrified, I'll never forget that. As soon as he came in the will, he felt peaceful, so his wife would not come and haunt him again. So that's a true story. So, you know, if you've got like a will which hasn't been paid out or something, then you come and haunt your relations, first of all. So remember, whatever the will says, you better actually honour it and don't change it. Otherwise, someone's going to come to you in the middle of the night and give you a very hard time. So sometimes, when the business is done, then you can go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in your wisdom, what is mind? Where is mind? And what is its relationship to the brain? Thank you. Are you happy now? If you're happy, put up your right hand. If you're miserable, put up your left hand. And be honest. Okay? Put up your hand right up. Now, if you're happy, now point to the happiness for me. Point to it. Locate it. Where is it? What do you mean? Were you imagining the happiness? Was it in your ear? In your toe? Why do you know that happiness exists, but you can't locate it? Next time you're angry, locate anger. Where is it? Next time you're in love, where is love? Where is it located? You cannot locate these things in space because all these things belong in the mental world. Just like flowers live in the garden, anger, love, kindness, happiness, they live in the mind. You cannot locate it in space because it doesn't live in space. It has its own dimension, if you like, the world of the mind. So the world of the mind doesn't live in the brain. It's a separate world. That's what the mind is. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what is a deva? It is a heavenly being. A deva. In Latin, deus, theos, theology, Zeus, all the same word. So the deva, that literally means a bright being. So when they appear like a beautiful light. A beautiful light again, like a nimitta. Because these are mind-made beings. So when they come in the middle of the night and your whole room is radiant. What's going on? Is it a fire? Someone turned the light on? Or is it a deva? Wait and see. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the story. Born Buddhist, failed Buddhism in year 10 examination and managed to pass a second time. It was okay. Now do meditation to shorten the wheel of samsara and feel healthier than before. It looks like I'm going to live longer life. My question is, am I a winner or a loser? You are neither a winner, nor are you a loser. You lose yourself and all your judgments, and you win peace. So that's what we do. Lose all of your judgment and win happiness. Would you mind explaining why it's okay for you to eat meat with regard to the whole non-harming of other beings precept? Yet the monastics are only allowed to eat before 12 p.m. Why is that so important? Also, you said in your book that people having sex will not become enlightened. What if they choose to simply to keep their loved one happy? Women are very good at that. Not disrespect intended, just confused. That's a very deep question. Okay, is it okay for you to... Would you mind explaining why it's okay for you to eat meat? When I was in Thailand, I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. And I was told that once you become a monk, you can't choose. You have to eat what the people give you. And that wasn't an excuse, because the food I ate was disgusting. Did I tell you the... I told you the frog on rice, didn't I? Is it here? Yeah, I did tell you that. Did I not? The frog on rice? That must be somewhere else. One of the grossest pieces of food we ever had. One meal a day, no breakfast, just lunch. Sticky rice, a ball of sticky rice with a frog on top. Boiled frog. No garlic, no sauce, no soy sauce or anything like that. Just boiled frog on top of rice. I would have given anything to be a vegetarian then, but that's all you had. So you started eating at the legs of the flock, like chicken. But that wasn't enough to keep you going for another day. So you started picking at the organs inside. You had to get something to eat. And at least, you know, I was good at school. I studied. I remember my biology. The monk sitting next to me hadn't studied. He pressed the frog's bladder. It still had urine in, and the dead frog peed all over his rice. Doesn't matter how hungry you are, you can't keep eating after that. Now that was one gross. Another thing was frog soup. No, tiny frog, that was a big frog. This was a tiny frog. And, you know, you had the pot, you can take as many as you like. It was just boiled water. Again, no sort of salt or anything, so leaves or anything to make it taste nice. Just these little frogs just floating in it. Just big enough for your spoon. And you just had some rice and put the whole frog in your mouth and went crunch. And I remember there used to be this program, it was pre-Monty Python, called I'm Sorry I'll Read That Again. And they had one of the sketches was Crunchy Frog. I remember that, you know, when I was at university. Crunchy Frog, get your Crunchy Frog. And they were setting this in the movie theatres, you know, instead of like peanuts or popcorn or ice cream, Crunchy Frog. And then someone took a Crunchy Frog and said, there's still bones in it. Yeah, that's because it's crunchy. And that was just so gross and coarse. And we laughed at that as the students. And now I was eating Crunchy Frog. Really gross. We also used to eat water buffalo after birth. Now, the placenta from the water buffalo after it died, that was actually vegetarian. Because, you know, it was just left over. You didn't have to kill or hurt anybody. It was just things which were thrown away. Snails, all sorts of stuff we used to eat. So that's what it's like being a monk. You have to eat whatever you're given. So these days, it's actually, we don't get it anymore. Thank goodness. Don't say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, I've got something for you from your early... You don't do that enough. What's the other questions? I've lost them all now. What are the other questions in there? Where did it go? It disappeared. Went to nothingness. No? Okay. What are the other questions in that? There's me and... Sorry? Eating after midday. That's just to try and make things simple. How much time do you spend cooking, washing up afterwards? And how long does it take to actually eat? 5 or 10 minutes and it's all gone. And the amount of time you have to put in for that 5 or 10 minutes of eating is huge. So we want to get it all over and done with. I told many people, just make one meal a day for your husband, a big meal, however much he wants, and that's it. One feed a day. And then you don't have to spend so much time washing up and cooking. You have a free day. So it just gives you more time when you eat one meal a day. That's all. What was the other question? Oh. Ah, why do you remember that one? Sorry, guys. Yeah, when you have sex with your partner for happiness. Look, you can't get excited anymore. So they just, whatever they do, you can't get excited. So it's a waste of time. It's like, you know, I shouldn't go. I think I'll get that stop now before I get into more trouble. So anyway, next question. Why do I sometimes feel nausea when I'm meditating? I don't know, maybe to take some anti-acid or something. It may be because you're eating too much at lunchtime. Maybe not exercising so much. You usually don't feel nausea when you're meditating. You usually feel very peaceful and nice. Especially in the evening. You can't be feeling nauseous when in the evening you haven't eaten anything. There's nothing to be nauseous about. Unless you've been really pigging out on the cheese and chocolate. That's more like it. Eating so much cheese and chocolate is making you nauseous. No, it's usually not the case. It's usually some physical thing, nothing to do with meditation. Oh, here it is, the one. Okay, keep them happy. The last question. Good. I would like to know more about Thai Buddhism. For a Thai lay practice, what is their daily practice? There's all sorts of practices for Thai Buddhists. You know, a lot of times they only practice once a year when they go to the temple for Vaisak. We call those Vaisak Buddhists. And there's some people who practice all the time. So remember, there's not really any such thing as Thai Buddhism. There is Buddhism with Thai culture on top of it. There is Chinese culture on top of Buddhism, but it's not Chinese Buddhism. There is Korean culture on top of Buddhism, but it's all Buddhism. Real Buddhism is international, and if you understand what real Buddhism is, you'll see in all these different lands, it's just the same cake with different icing. A lot of the time, though, the icing is so thick with all the traditions and rituals, you can never actually get to what Buddhism is. I remember just our local professor of physics here in University of Western Australia, Professor David Blair, when he told me once that he went to Thailand as a young man, he was very interested in Buddhism, but he couldn't get close to Buddhism. All he had was the rituals and the chanting and the bowing and all the cultural additions. So I said, yeah, that's what the case is. In many places you can't get to the Buddha. He's covered up with all the incense smoke. You can't even see the Buddha. All the customs, all the rituals, which means you can't really get close to what Buddhism is really teaching. If you can find the real Buddhism, whether it's in Thailand, whether it's in Burma, whether it's in Korea or Japan, if you get to the real Buddhism, it's all the same. Eightfold Path. Making peace, being kind, being gentle, compassion, being a good person. So a lot of times the culture is so strong that people can't even see the Buddhism. Too much icing. That's why when we come to Australia, we come to the West, we can take all the icing off and just get the cake, which is much healthier for you. So, you know, there's many, many traditions. This isn't really a traditional retreat you're doing here. You know, yeah, you bow every now and again. I mess around with the sadhus. No one in Thailand does sadhu, sadhu, sadhu really over the top. It's all respectful. But this is the best respect, respect for the Dhamma and the joy of meditating. And what other stuff? Look, Thai Buddhism, I remember this in Thai Buddhism. When I first went there, had all these people who were supposed to be keeping the five precepts. But they were all fishing. And I asked them, how can you catch fish and think that you are keeping the five precepts? You're killing the fish. They said, no, 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 we're not killing the fish. We just take them out of the water and they die by themselves. So that's where you can see the culture, which is going on. We used to love Thailand that way. They're just so practical and simple and just, they like fun. So I really liked them because they were very funny. When they used to do the five precepts, this was only when I went back after many years. Usually you put your hands up when you take the five precepts, you see people doing this. But when I went back once, I saw one person doing this. I've never seen that in all the years I was in Thailand. So I asked him, what are you doing? He said, oh, today I'm only keeping four precepts. They still chanted all five. And once I saw that, I really looked, and of course I saw one with two fingers down. I saw one with all the five fingers down. They weren't keeping any precepts today, but they would still chant everything. Just like in Sri Lanka. Well, actually the Sri Lankans here in, first heard this in Melbourne. You know that sometimes we have the eight precepts, usually on the holy days, they're called Poya days. In some Sri Lankan temples, on the Poya days, they keep 13 precepts. They keep eight precepts in the morning and five precepts in the afternoon. That's called the 13 precepts. In other words, they say, I will not eat in the afternoon. They say that in the morning. And in the afternoon, they say, five precepts now. So just messing around, just because people be people. Do they meditate? Generally, it's a commitment to practice. There's much more meditation now. Again, Thai people were stereotyped, that Thais just offer dana to the monks, and they don't do anything else. But look, how many Thai people are meditating here? And they keep their precepts. So it's really good. There are some Thai people, some Sri Lankan people, they just, you know, they say the precepts, but they don't keep it. And they sort of call themselves Buddhists, but they never meditate. But there's many, many more who are these days. So I think a lot of times that many Thai people, Sri Lankan people, Burmese people are actually looking back and realizing, let's not just do the culture, let's do the real Buddhism. And they're coming much closer to real Buddhism again. Is there a leader like Tibetans have, the Dalai Lama? No, there's no, actually there is a leader. When the Buddha passed away, or just before he passed away, he said, people asked him, who's going to be the leader once you're gone? Now give us a successor. And the Buddha famously said, once I pass away, the Dhamma and the Vinaya, the Dhamma, you know the word Dhamma, and the training, that will be your teacher from now on. And that was an awesome thing he said. It meant that we cannot have a Dalai Lama, a Pope, or an Archbishop of Canterbury in our religion. Totally devolved the authority. So every monastery is independent. We don't have Mahanayakas, Sangharajas. That is just added by the culture of the country in which you live. Real Buddhism, there is no leader. You follow the Dhamma, the teachings. You follow the training. That's your leader. That's amazing. Other than regular meditation, what do you do to prepare for a good death? The best way to prepare for a good death is to have a good life. Have a good life and then you'll have a good death. Don't think I'm going to have a bad life in the last few moments. I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to die tomorrow, so I'll take the five precepts now. And I'll start meditating now because, you know, I've only got one day to go. Okay, I've been a bad boy before, but now I'm going to be good. It's a bit late. It's just like the person who starts to study the night before the exam. Let it too late. How often and for what occasion do you come together at the temple and what do you do? Usually in real Buddhism you come together as infrequently as possible. In other words, as Buddhist monks you try to be hermits. That's why you can go over to Bodhinyana Monastery. If you go in the afternoon, you shouldn't be able to see any monks who are all in their huts meditating. I hope. So we're a community of hermits spending a lot of time in solitude. Only come together when there's a reason, like having lunch together, just as practicalities, and then disappearing. And sometimes you don't see them until the next day for lunch. Sometimes there's chores to do, we do chores together, but we don't do that much chores these days. Bodhinyana Monastery is mostly built now, so it's very easy to look after. And we come together once a fortnight to do a recitation of our rules, again just to make sure everyone's okay. And at that time we have any things need to be discussed about running the monastery. I am not the spiritual dictator, I'm just called the spiritual director. So, you know, it's a democracy and sometimes I get overruled, which is wonderful. So, for example, if I have to go during the rains retreat somewhere, I ask the monks, first of all, do you think I should go? Sometimes they say, no, you've gone too much, stay here. So I stay. So this is actually how we manage our monastery. So that's roughly how it works. So, democracy. No big leader overarching everybody. The Dhamma and the Vinaya is your leader. You know, that's much better. What happens then when there's no hierarchies? In Thailand they've established a hierarchy, but that was just the state of Thailand trying to organize all the monks. Before that time it was basically every monastery was independent. If it was a good monastery, a good teacher, then it would flourish. If it was a bad monastery, it would just fade away. Just like a tree in the forest, If it's a good seed planted in the right place, it becomes a huge, lovely tree, giving shade to many animals and people. If it was in the wrong place, a bad seed, no water, of course it would just die. So that natural selection. And that was the best way for monasteries. If they're doing the right thing, they might experiment and get it wrong, then they would suffer. If they experiment and get it right, they would grow. And that natural selection was always the way that Buddhism flourished, without any hierarchy, without anybody telling you what you should be doing. So actually, that was original Buddhism. He said that, just keep the rules, follow the Dhamma, follow the Vinaya, and you'll flourish. So you're not beholden to anybody. No archbishops, no popes, no cardinals, because that's where you get corruption. Well, that's how we practice it here. So, any questions about that? And again, there's so many questions. So, if I didn't answer your question fully, or it was a serious question and I treated it as a joke, please, that means it was your karma. Nothing to do with me. But if you really want to ask the question again, write it again the next time. So, some questions I treat seriously, some I use a bit of humour. If I treat everyone seriously, by this time, which is 9:20, you'd all be fast asleep. You'd be bored silly. So this time I make it a bit fun, give it a bit more joy, answer some questions seriously, and in between a few jests and a ghost story or two, just to give you that entertainment. So today you heard the ghost story of the coffin and how the coffin mix stops the coffin. Ha ha ha.